Welcome to another episode of Table Setters covering all things Major League Baseball. As always, I'm Steve here with my partner, Devin. What's going on, dude?
Just got the Mets on in the background here. It's been a crazy week in baseball. That's all I can say. Lots to talk about, some positives, some negatives, but it's amazing what happens in a week.
Yeah, I was in the shadow of Citizens Bank Park today. This weekend, I should say, in Philadelphia. And I got to say, one of the most underrated ballparks in all of baseball. I've been there for a game, but watching it from the high heights of Lincoln Financial at WrestleMania, looking through and just looking at that park with the bright lights, man, that park is underrated. I think it's a top five ballpark in baseball.
Yeah, I'll give you that. I've only been in the stadium once. I've been in that complex a few times. How do you feel about all the stadiums being together? What are your thoughts on that?
I think, to me, dude, that's like the benchmark of what you should do. Have an Xfinity Live in the middle, Wells Fargo with the Flyers and Phillies, and then you get the Eagles there. It's just like, it's a sports fans' dream of just road games, home games. You have an epicenter for that. I mean, in New York, we have travel miles down driving and trains to get to where we need to go. Like, we need to have that City Field complex. Let's put New York City Football Club there. Maybe the Islanders could have been there, and the Mets would have been the perfect hub for all sports.
Yeah, all our stuff is so spread out, which I guess that's what I'm used to. So when I see that in Philly, I'm kind of like, why are these all in one spot? But it's super convenient. And yeah, like you said, the City Field thing, once they, you know, Cohen is trying to put his mark on and making it more of a kind of destination with, you know, shopping and hotels and, you know, the soccer team as well. I'm looking forward to that, because if you've ever been to City Field or Shea Stadium before, it's just the stadium and then a bunch of chop shops, dirt roads around. It's crazy, but they could make it really nice. It's right near the water over there. So like, it has the potential to be nice. So we'll see what happens.
Well, the highlights around Yankee Stadium in the Bronx is that McDonald's, where everybody would meet getting off the train. So we don't quite have the attraction outside. We don't have the outside the stadium experience outside of stands and Billy's for Yankee fans. But other than that, I mean, I'm kind of jealous that Philly has what they have there, because like I said, we saw it being the highlight during the World Series. Xfinity Live during those road games was just absolutely wild. So really cool to see. But if you guys are liking what you're listening to, make sure you guys go to Instagram and X and follow us at Table Setters Pod. We're here posting. Devin is working his ass off, putting some reels out there, putting clips of the show, some nostalgia things out there, trying to grow the social media presence. So if you happen to find us here talking baseball, please support the show. It's the best way to do it is by sharing, telling a friend, getting involved in the conversation. We're going to be doing the show weekly for the whole season. Let us be your guide through 162 games. We're already on our way through that journey. It's a long way to go, but you know, hop along. We'll give you all you need as far as news and conversation about Major League Baseball.
Yeah, man. I think we pride ourselves on trying to get to a little bit of everything, try to cover different teams each week and not just talk about the same, you know, players and squads every week. We talk about baseball, the past baseball, the future prospects, current stars, guys that are aging out a little bit. Whereas, you know, you turn on ESPN and things like that, you're probably just going to hear about Shohei and the Dodgers and, you know, LeBron James, if you're into basketball, over and over and over again. So that's what they do. We're going to kind of give you a little bit of everything here, which if you're a super big baseball fan, I think that's what you want.
So we're here with the open and say here. We're going to get into what caught our eye this week. And I'll let you start, Devin, with what caught your eye. Of course, we're going to get into the meat of the order eventually. And that's pretty much where I'm left at, where the off the field stuff has been the most eye grabbing. All the headlines have been coming out of the injuries and some big names going down. But for you, someone on the field caught your eye and really has you impressed.
Yeah, it's Ellie De La Cruz, and I'm not the only one there. I was just so excited to see last night what he did, because Ellie came up with so much fanfare last year, well deserved at 21 years old, and then after his first couple months, when reality hit and pitchers kind of figured some things out and adjusted to him, like they do every rookie, by the way. He just started getting some, I don't want to say hate, but skepticism very quickly. And I guess that's just the world we live in, where, you know, you're treating a guy like a king one moment, and then the next moment you're like, actually, I don't even think he's very good. I think he's going to be a bust. And there was a lot of that going into the season. He's a polarizing guy as far as how good he's going to be. But, I mean, let the guy be a kid. He's still only 22. And the big point that people make that are kind of negative towards him is the strikeout rate, which I get it, but he's far from the only one who has that issue. Rookies and vets the same. So yeah, anyway, if you didn't see it, over 450 foot home run, and also an inside the park home run where he went all the way around the bases in less than 15 seconds. And he was the first guy to have both of those things, a over 450 foot home run and an inside the park home run in the same game since the StatCast era began. And I'd be willing to say he's probably one of the only ones ever to do that. I wish we knew a little bit more, if we could go further back, but I'm so curious to see how Ellie does throughout an entire season here. The Reds are a little banged up with some of their other young guys. So he's, you know, he's in the thick of things, and he's just electric when he has one of those nights. You can't take your eyes off him. The crowd, if they're home, goes nuts. And I would venture to say that even if it was a road game, the fans would not be able to contain their excitement seeing him, even if he's going against them. So he's just that kind of player. I am rooting for him. Can't stand the people that are kind of trying to root for his downfall so early on. But he's fun. He's what baseball absolutely positively needs. You put guys like that on the field, or Ronald Acuna or Fernando Tatis, regardless of how you feel about him. That's what this game needs, man. More positivity like that. Just electric athletes. So
I agree, dude. And I think Ellie De La Cruz is the cool factor. And I think O'Neill Cruz brings that as well. There's a couple of players, Fernando Tatis, as you mentioned, even guys like Bo Bichette, they bring a cool factor to the game that was non-existent for many years. And if you go back to our childhood, what made us and what impressed us when we were kids was the Ken Griffey Jr. hat backwards, the sweet swing, and getting people to transcend and become these larger than life stars. And I feel like Ellie's on the way doing that. And the play on the field is transcending to a level where we expected it to be there. And of course, as you mentioned, it's a different game. Strikeouts exist in a way that they didn't exist back in the day. And I think analytics account for that. I think making him valuable on the field, it's not really about making contact as much as it used to be. It's sometimes you're going to strike out and it doesn't make him less of a player, but it's also just, you got to remember, like, that's how he's approaching the game. That's how he came up through the minors. That's how he's been taught. The hitting coaches also have the same analytics that Ellie's using. It's kind of this thing. And we're going to talk about it throughout the me the order with the injuries. The stuff that goes on in baseball is all the way from the lowest level to the top, you know, obviously Major League Baseball. It's one of those things where it's a trickle-down effect where we see approaches change, and Ellie has used really what has worked to get to that level, and he's finding a way onto the field, and that's what he's been taught. He's a young guy who's come up through the minor league system, and that's what's valued. It's power and it's speed.
Yeah, and you have to be careful messing around too much with a guy like that. Obviously, you want to try to cut the K rate a little bit. And I know they also were kind of getting him to hit the ball in the air more, because obviously when he hits the ball in the air, it goes. And so they were trying to mess with his launch angle a little bit. But you got to be not too much at once, because you could really mess a guy up like that. Like they talk about pitchers. A lot of times pitchers come out of college and these major league coaches try to change everything. And it's like, well, I was super successful with this, so let's maybe not change everything. Let's, you know, find a happy medium there. So that's what I think the Reds are doing a good job. They originally thought they were going to have him in the two spot, and they've had him in the sixth spot, I think maybe every single game so far. And I'm kind of okay with that for now, because I think it takes a little pressure off having him not all the way down there, but the sixth spot to me is a good spot for him right now. And once he starts really feeling it, then maybe you work him up in that two spot. But he's kind of a guy who can hit anywhere in the order, maybe not lead off, even though he's speed, he's so fast, but because of the strikeout rate, you'd probably want a guy with a little more contact in that spot. But he's fantastic, and like I said, I'm rooting for the kid.
Yeah, he's great for baseball. Seeing what he's done in the Reds offense has been exciting. They're scoring runs at a high clip right now. They have a differential of +8. They're losing tonight, but it's not because of the offense. They scored 5 runs. So Their offense has been clicking on all cylinders, and it's fun to see that ballpark. We mentioned Citizens Bank, but Great American Ballpark is one of the best ballparks in all of baseball. When the fans are filling the park and they're loud and energetic, that place is electric. So I think Ellie is a reason to be excited if you're a Red fan. If you're just a fan of baseball, he's a guy that we're excited to watch grow, because this is the entry point, the infancy of his career. And hopefully if he lives up to the potential, we could be talking about a career that's, you know, 10, 15 years in the making.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's a lot of pressure, the expectations that have been put on him right away. But I think it's great for him to be surrounded by so much other young talent, because they can kind of come up and do it together. But some other things that caught my eye, as far as a guy, you know, who's been around for a while, used to have that pressure. Mike Trout, man, he's turning back the clock a little bit here. Home runs, some stolen bases, had a triple last night. I think he was either a single or a double short of the cycle. Might have been a double short of the cycle. And the Angels are winning some games, too. They have a winning record right now, so who knows? I know we're pretty hard on them, but if we want to root for Mike Trout, I guess we have to root a little bit for the Angels too, being that he's probably not getting out of there, even though we've wished he would. So my curiosity is, he came out and said he wants to try to steal 20 bases this year. We know Ron Washington is pushing that amongst the team, but who knows if he said anything to Trout. I feel like Trout would have to kind of decide that on his own with his, you know, status in that clubhouse. So it's exciting to see, because he did not look great in spring training and at times just looked frustrated. I don't want to say uninterested, because I don't think he's that kind of guy, but he looks like he's into it. We just got to hope he stays healthy and see what he does. Maybe he can put together another MVP season. And then last but not least, as far as other things on my notes that caught my eye, this goes back to one thing I said I was going to watch last week coming up, and that was the Diamondbacks. I said, I think the Diamondbacks Braves series, I thought that was a litmus test for the Diamondbacks. Not so great. They're having a rough start here. They've blown some leads. They lost 2 of 3 to the Yankees and then got swept by the Braves. Even in they had a big lead in one of those games, maybe two. They lost the first one to the Rockies last night as well. So, you know, we're looking for them to get right. I think they have a good team, but you don't want to fall too far behind the Dodgers early on. Ketel Marte has been unbelievable for that team. So to see a guy just tearing it up like that and the team's record not really showing, you know, signs of life, is surprising to me. So I'm looking for them to turn it around. They got to take 2 or 3 from the Rockies. They can't be losing a series to those guys.
Yeah, I saw Corbin Carroll had a home run today, and they need him to get going and get to the level he was at last year. But looking at the slow start, I mean, you mentioned some of the series they had, losing 2 of 3 to the red-hot Yankees, getting swept by the Braves. I know they've been beleaguered with injuries, and fingers crossed for Spencer Strider. We'll talk about him later. Getting swept by the Braves is no small feat. You know, it's one of those things, but you're right. I think the most alarming thing is losing that opening game to the Rockies. They're up today. So hopefully, like you said, they can pull the last 2-3 out of the series and kind of get going and lead the series with the Rockies and have a better start. Because we've seen, I mean, even when we were talking about the Mets, they're on the losing side of it right now, but you see how quickly it turns. Even here in New York, it was all doom and gloom. There's no conversation about the sky is falling, but here we are now where the Mets kind of, you know, get back in the mix. They're still under 500, of course, but getting a couple of wins certainly quells some of the anxiety. And I'm sure in Arizona, Sports Talk Radio is, you know, they're having a doom and gloom conversation, especially after a loss to the Rockies, but they'll be back in good graces. That's the marathon, and that is the baseball season. So all is well, unless you're Miami or Oakland or Chicago, I would say, on the South side. So
out of those three, just a quick answer. Out of those three teams you just named, White Sox, Athletics, Marlins, who do you think's in the worst shape?
I think it's Miami. I mean, maybe I'm watching them too closely because they're playing the Yankees right now, but they just look absolutely hapless. They have no heart. 1-10 at this point, looking like they're on the way to 1-11. It is absolutely atrocious, the baseball we're seeing being put out there. And I don't know, we could be looking at a historically bad team at this point, unless they go off on and run off, you know, 7-8 straight wins sometime in the season. I just don't see how that happens, especially with the injuries to the pitching too. That's the other thing that I'm talking about. They're not scoring runs, true, but losing Yuri Perez, he's just on top of that with Sandy Alcantara. And I mean, dude, it's a mess in Miami, and there's no real help on the way right now.
No, I mean, it's funny because Skip Schumacher was the manager of the year last year and well-deserved. I mean, if he wants to win another one of those, just get to 500 with this team. Yes. I think he would deserve it again. Yeah, things change quickly. I my answer is the White Sox. I know, you know, the funny thing is, I don't think either of us took the easy answer. I think the easy answer is the A's with all the BS that's going on with that organization, but I'm not going to come down to the players there because, you know, I think the players are doing the best they can and the front office is a joke, but the White Sox, I think the White Sox have done the right thing with pretty much committing to a teardown and starting over. But just to see the same guys, the stars that are still there, continue to get hurt month after month, year after year. You know, Eloy first was banged up, and then Luis Robert out for a while. And then tonight I was watching the game and Yoan Moncada went down in a heap, like severe pain, couldn't make it down the first baseline. I think it was either a groin or a hamstring.
They're calling it an adductor strain. That's what they're calling it.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, probably like a groin. I saw they signed Mike Clevinger. I don't even understand why. Like, number one, why he would go there. I guess maybe he didn't have any other offers. And why they would even spend money on that. Like, I guess they just need bodies at this point. But I wouldn't be shocked to see them have the worst record at the end of the year with the way things are going.
Yeah, I think there's no wrong answer out of those three teams. As you mentioned, they all have things in their favor. And as we know, as I mentioned before, the same breath, baseball is a marathon. So one of those teams is destined to get hot by just accidental luck at some point this year, just by sheer friendship and love and respect and whatever it takes to sometimes go on a rally. But early on in the year, you're digging yourself a really big hole. All three of those teams, and the Marlins right now are in the worst shape, but Chicago and Oakland are not in any better shape. And as you mentioned before, injuries are piling up, and that means that the depth is being challenged, and it's really exposing these organizations that don't have the depth to have the next man up. We always compliment the Rays. We compliment the Dodgers, even the D-backs last year, calling guys up for the minor league system and contributing. Some of these teams that don't have the depth in the minor league system, and they're being asked to have them come up. As you mentioned, all those big guys that went down with Chicago, it's exposing that those guys are not major league ready very quickly. The AAA, the divide between AAA and major league is pretty apparent in those organizations.
Yeah, Ozzie Guillen, there was a clip of him, I guess, on a White Sox post-game or pre-game show when some of these injuries happened, saying, 10, 15, 20 years ago, guys would drink like a bunch of beers after, have a couple burgers, and his line was, you can't pull fat. So I don't know, maybe we need to stop working out so much or something. Maybe he's on to something.
It's the age-old question with John Carl Stanton. I mean, that's been the conversation where he's always been a specimen. He's always been a muscular guy, but he became this otherworldly muscular build with the Yankees, and that's where he's been the most apt to be injured. If you go back to his tenure with the Marlins, dude was on the field. Like, you know what I mean? He was always on the field with the Marlins and with the Yanks. He's on the field now. It's not like he's playing. Not that he's not playing, but he's not contributing the same way he was. He's not the same player. But also to shovel a little more dirt onto the Marlins, they released during the game with, obviously the Yanks were playing them during the series, and they had a graphic of the most home runs, I think it was in the last 5 years or less, or maybe the last 10 years. And Giancarlo Stanton is still at the top of the list of Marlins active players. So not a good thing. He hasn't been on the team for about 7 years at this point.
No, I mean, is Ozuna and Yelich right behind him too on that list? Like,
I wish I pulled the clip so I can get it. So I'll do some homework and bring it back next week so we can have it. It was alarming to see that he was still residing at the top list despite not putting on a Marlins uniform for the past 7 years.
Yeah, that's not a positive. That's not a good thing.
All right, well, let's get to the meat of the order. And speaking of injuries, get into the depth of our conversation, why we're here, all the stuff that's going on with the pitchers. All right, Devin, here in the meat of the order, talking about these pitching injuries, and we have two sides having conversations. Of course, there's the MLB Players Association, and there's the actual league. And I think this got caught on fire, of course, when you have some big names going down. We don't know the extent of some of the injuries, but we have, of course, the latest here is Framber Valdez continues an unfortunate streak of these pitching injuries. We saw stars like Shane Bieber, Yuri Perez acquiring season-ending surgeries. And of course, the big name this weekend was Spencer Strider, who's probably the de facto best pitcher in the league right now. He's going to go check out the severity of his injury, but there's concern that he may need surgery as well. Join the list of Shohei Ohtani, Jacob deGrom, Sandy Alcantara, Robbie Ray, Shane McClanahan, and many more minor league players underneath depth players that are facing arm injuries. It's causing a dispute between the MLB Players Association and the league because, Devin, they're contributing this to the rule change, and we'll get into some of the accusations that the Players Association is making. We actually have the letter from Tony Clark that's in here. Pretty damning stuff here. And as we know, the league is going in a different direction, and they're trying their best to right the wrongs of the things that went down with the Astros and trying to keep a squeaky clean image, and they want to, at the same time, fix pace of play. That's been the key word, the buzzword for everybody, is get the game underneath in a digestible amount of time. If you're looking at Rob Manfred's wet dream that we had last night with the Yankees, a 2 hour and 1 minute game, which just have to be, I mean, did the dude throw a party? Cause that was exactly what they wanted. They try to get it between 2 hours and 30 minutes and 2 hours and 45 minutes, but long gone are the days where we would have those 4 or 5 hour Yankee Red Sox games. We're not really getting that anymore.
Yeah. This topic is so complicated. And one thing that got on my nerves, you know, the day that the Shane Bieber and Spencer Strider stuff came out, is when this really started to blow up. Even though we've already had the Gerrit Cole stuff and a couple other things before it, when Bieber suddenly out of nowhere, his was a surprise because it was like no one heard of anything about him getting an MRI or having any pain or anything. They must have kept it quiet. He was dominant, maybe the best pitcher in the league in his first two starts, led the league in strikeouts, hadn't given up a run. The whole talk in spring training as a guy who owns him in fantasy was about how he added a couple miles per hour, which now I look at and I have a few thoughts about that. A few miles per hour to his pitches, worked with driveline. I also have some thoughts about that. Anyway, when those two things were announced, the topic blew up. And when I went on Twitter, one of the first two posts I saw were people on there that I like their accounts, and I won't name them because this is something I didn't necessarily agree with, but just immediately and definitively blaming all of this on the pitch clock with like no doubts in their mind, like basically saying it's 100%. And there were more people doing that. And honestly, the Players Association, obviously, like you mentioned, went right for that too. I was shocked that they put something out there that quick and that like strongly worded. And I was even more shocked at how quickly Major League Baseball responded. Here's the thing I will say. I'm not going to sit here and say the pitch clock has nothing to do with this. I think it's probably a factor. How big of one? I don't know. I think they're going to need to, you know, study it and figure it out. What I don't understand is last year was such a success with the pace of play. It worked better than I think anyone could have imagined. Why did they so quickly take even more time off the clock? That, to me, seems completely unreasonable and unnecessary, and it gives the Players Association like kind of a reason to be as aggressive as they were with this topic. It was just, again, to me, completely unnecessary, and I just don't understand it. Like, you won. Like, stop for a little while. Just take your win.
Yeah, I agree with that. And looking at Tony Clark's statement that he released on behalf of the MLBPA, he said, despite unanimous player opposition and significant concerns regarding health and safety, the commissioner's office reduced the length of the pitch clock last December, just one season removed from imposing the most significant rule change in decades. Continued since then, our concerns about the health impacts of the reduced recovery time have only intensified. The league's unwillingness thus far to acknowledge or study the effects of these profound changes is an unprecedented threat to our game and its most valuable asset, the players. So the league wasted no time getting in there and responding, because you mentioned too, they snuck a few things in. They reduced the time or the added time between trying to shave those things with the pace of play. They also added the ghost man on second again, which snuck in because that was disappearing from the game from what we understood in December, but it made its way back. And MLB quickly countered to Tony Clark what he was saying. He said that, and this is written, I'm not sure if it's Rob Manfred, it might be a lawyer for MLB, but this is just what the league stance is. And they said this statement ignores the empirical evidence and much more significant long-term trend over multiple decades of velocity and spin increases highly correlated with arm injuries. Nobody wants to see pitchers get hurt in this game, which is why MLB is currently undergoing a significant comprehensive research study into the causes of this long-term increase, interviewing prominent medical experts across baseball, which to date has been consistent with an independent analysis by Johns Hopkins University that found no evidence to support that the introduction of a pitch clock has increased injuries. They continue, John Hopkins found no evidence that pitchers who worked quickly in 2023 were more likely to sustain an injury than those who worked less quickly on average. JHU also found no evidence that pitchers who sped up their pace were more likely to sustain an injury than those that did not. All right, so there's been a lot of the outlets covering all our favorite Twitter accounts. If you read Ben Lindbergh or from The Ringer, or if you read The Athletic, everybody's talking about this, trying to come up with why is this happening. And if you're looking at some of the reasons you mentioned before, the pitch clock, and we can talk about that, but you also talk about grip, the spider tack stuff. You talk about releasing the grip, and we'll get into Tyler Glasnow's clip from last year talking about why he feels like this is a thing that is going to be, Verlander called it a pandemic, but I think it's an epidemic as far as injuries go. But the other thing that people aren't talking about is the analytics part, because the analytics of the studies that link fastball velocity to better outcomes means that the faster you throw, the better you're going to have at the outcomes. I mean, we have Mike Fast's seminal piece on the subject culminating most recently with the Stuff Plus, where you have analysts talking about they need to get strikeouts. You cannot let the players make contact with the ball, which means throwing hard will get them there. And then with Justin Verlander, he's talking about this starts at the smallest level. You know, you're teaching these throwing programs to show 10 to 14-year-olds how to throw harder. Inevitably, the arm cannot sustain that. So at some point, it is a domino effect to get these pitchers that get to the major league level. There's a lot more innings on their arm and not protecting. Verlander was talking about it in that the interview that he was being careful with his words. He's a consummate professional and he was very well spoken about it. But he was talking about when he was going through high school, he really didn't teach himself to throw really hard until college. It was more about pitching and learning the science of pitching and where placement and protecting his arm. Now you've got kids that are in junior high. I mean, you could speak to, you played high school ball. It's hard that to imagine the pressure on these pitchers to get to the highest level. It's about throwing hard. Now you have to throw 95 to 98 to even sniff anything that is a top elite program in college.
Yeah. And what we see is the guys that can throw hard and also let's mention spin too. It's because it's not just velocity, the RPMs, right? If you can put a bunch of spin on the ball as well, which is, you know, not going to make the elbow feel good. That's who gets a look. That's who gets the big contract. So high school kids and kids even younger see that. And that's what they start working on. And unfortunately, there's coaches out there more than likely that should know better, that are trying to make a name for themselves through kids that are probably encouraging that too, which they should not be. I remember I was never really a pitcher, even though I played for years. Pitching wasn't my thing. But I remember, you know, friends of mine that played, you know, were basically told, do not even try throwing a curveball until you're at least like 13, 14 years old. You should not even attempt it before then. I wonder if that's something that still exists. Like if that is still something that coaches are telling their kids or parents are telling their kids. But this, there was also another thing where a doctor had said that, you know, a doctor that works on, you know, elbow injuries and things like that, Tommy John surgery, said when he started his career, these injuries were basically top down. So the majority of them were like major league guys or guys of that age. And then the next most prevalent were like college kids. And then the least prevalent were high school kids. And he said, now it's reversed. Like it's completely flip-flopped where the people he sees the most are high school kids. And then the next is the college and then major leagues. So that is alarming. And now we just keep on seeing guys are going on their second Tommy Johns. It's almost like if you're going to pitch for a long time, you might as well schedule your Tommy John surgery right now and then schedule your second one for like 5 or 6 years later. Like that, it sounds crazy. And that's a big shame. But another thing that Verlander had mentioned that I guess not as many people are talking about is he felt like this intensified when they changed the ball and the ball started jumping out of the ballpark more. So like we could call it the live ball era. And I think there's some weight to that. The pitchers basically said they had to change the way they pitched. They didn't want as much contact. I remember that year specifically as a Met fan. I'm listening to Gary Cohen a lot. I remember him being astounded with the amount of opposite field home runs that there were. In his words, I remember him talking about how there used to only be a couple people in the league that could hit opposite field home runs. And now guys like 7, 8, 9 hitters are popping it out, you know, opposite field, like significantly over the wall. So there's no, you know, there's no secrets. We know they changed the ball and pitchers tried to find a leg up and suddenly they didn't want to allow contact where it used to be. Listen, I'll locate a first pitch fastball and it won't be, you know, too fast hit. You're going to make contact. But if I locate it on the outside corner, first pitch, you ground out to shortstop or you ground out to second base. That's a quick out. Yep. And then like Verlander always says, Verlander is known for his velocity increasing as the game gets deeper. I remember like prime Verlander. I remember him, you know, 7th, 8th, sometimes 9th inning where he's trying to finish his outing. And all of a sudden he's throwing 2 or 3 miles per hour faster than he has been all game. And that's purposeful. He's saving some and using it when he needs it. And now, you know, first pitch of the game, we're trying to light up the radar gun. It's backwards, but it's not going to change if there's not a significant way to incentivize pitchers to do things differently. So I fear that it's just going to continue. I mean, this is crazy. This year has to be an outlier, and I hope it is. I hope it's not like more of what's to come every year. But
yeah, it's bad for the game to have stars that are going down with injuries, because at the end of the day, it's about having the best players on the field. And some of the best players in baseball are obviously pitchers. before we get into those rule changes that were recommended from Verlander and some of the other journalists out there in baseball, I guess we have the conversation about what role does a pitch clock have in contributing to injury? And I guess some conversation here, if you can look at just the obvious, if you're asking the pitchers to do the same work in less time, you're going to increase their fatigue and ask them to do more in less time. It's a basic understanding, but it shouldn't require research. But if you go through it, there really hasn't been a significant spike outside of the early surge in injuries of the first year of the clock. Looking at all the studies, there was not a difference in any of the injury rates from the year before. So I think this year, as you mentioned, might be an outlier, could be contributed. Maybe it's compounded by the fact this is the second year with this in place that you're having pitchers that are now on top of it. If you look at the workload, and Glasnow talks about it best when he talks about the grip of the ball on top of the pitch clock kind of situation, you can imagine that these guys are working harder. But the increase in injuries on the major league level has really been a slow burn, not a really big spike until this point. So I think right now MLBPA is panicking, and rightfully so, because you don't want your best big names going down with injuries. This is their livelihood. But the minor league UCLA injuries, as you mentioned, starting at a lower level in high school, but even so, there's more of it being exploded in the pitch clock in 2018 in the minor leagues. Because this, you got to remember that we have more anecdotal evidence from the minor leagues because it was introduced first. Went from 152 in 2017 to consistently over 200 the past three seasons. So I think this may be a precursor to what's going to be happening in the future, and we might be seeing a spike here on a different level. And keep in mind, some of the pitchers in the major leagues are pitching harder than those in the minor league. So
there has been a significant increase since the minors instituted the pitch clock.
Yes, 152 to 200 the past three seasons consistently. So that's an extra 50 players undergoing the injury. So it's not a good thing with the UCL or shoulder, whatever it is. It's affecting the pitchers at some rate. But I think, you mentioned before, I think it's compounded together. I think it's the ball. I think it's the analytics. It's the change of approach, but it's also the pitch clock, which might be exasperating the problem. I don't know if that's the cause, because even if you remove the pitch clock from the game, I think this still will be happening at a high rate. I don't believe it's the only thing happening and causing it.
I agree. I think you're right. I think maybe it's the straw that breaks the camel's back, and there's a lot of things leading up to it. One thing that no one I've heard mentioned is let's think about this as a 5-year scope, right? Go back to 2020, the COVID year that messed up everybody's workload, as far as, you know, whether it be a pitcher and how many innings you pitched, minor leaguers who just like didn't get game reps to a degree. So let's think about that as step one. COVID just kind of, you know, messed up everything. 2021 comes, everyone's trying to get back into the groove, but it takes a little while. And then I don't know if it was 2022. I think it was 2022 when all the spider tax stuff comes up. And, you know, they're changing the rules about what you're allowed to use for grip. And then you put the pitch clock on top of that. And then you shorten the pitch clock even more, which I think, like the pitch clock or don't, again, I don't understand why you had to do that so quickly. All of those things compounded. Yeah, like it makes sense that something significant is happening. And if you look at the NFL, like it or not, the NFL has protected their stars. All right. They saw, you know, 10 years ago, quarterbacks getting hit down low or in the head, and they have changed. They do not wait around. They change the rules immediately. They don't worry about what people are going to say about it because they want their stars on the field. And now we watch a game where, like, if you even get too close to the quarterback, you might be in trouble.
So you might be onto something with that, Devin. I think it may be the perception of what they value is the game. And I think we saw, you mentioned the year with the live ball that, you know, the famous Dodgers Astros World Series where the ball was just flying out of the ballpark. That was probably the most egregious version of it. But I think we're seeing where MLB stands. They believe offense is the most valuable piece of the game, and the stars are driven on hitting home runs. And that might be sacrificing the pitcher's health. And I think in twofold, I can see why MLBPA is very upset about this, because the biggest stars, and like for me growing up, some of the best stars in baseball were the pitchers. And of course, you can go back to 98 and people that are casual fans. We always talk about those casual fans trying to get those people to tune in. It's on home runs and it's on the offense, and people want to be at a barn burner 10-9 game more so than a 1-0 grinder. For me, that's baseball. That's art. That's poetic. But for the casual fan, and that's what this is all about, the pitch clock, it's and shortening the game for the attention span of the newer fan to get kids to watch the game, it's offense. And I think they're not doing it purposely. They don't want these guys to get hurt, but they want offense to increase. And then I think everything else goes by the wayside. They want more runs scored.
Well, if they're not careful, and if they don't do something to show that they're trying to figure out how to protect their pitchers, they open themselves up to conspiracy theories. I go back to how I started this conversation, saying some of the first tweets I saw just pissed me off about just like 100% sure it was a pitch clock. The one that really got under my skin was this guy went to the lengths of saying not only was it the pitch clock's fault, but that they purposely instituted the pitch clock because they knew it would get pitchers hurt and then their offense would increase.
Let's
like
just
they were
ask
actually nine. Trying to, yeah, but you open your, and I agree, like it was ridiculous. But if you don't do something to show that you have that side of the game's backs, like the pitcher's backs, you're opening yourself up to that type of criticism. So they have to do something to try to help these guys stay on the field. And it starts at the bottom where you have to have middle school baseball players, high school baseball players watching the game and not only seeing guys be rewarded that can spin the ball like crazy and throw the ball 99, 100, 101. Like, that's the question. Like, how do you do it?
It's an institutional issue at this point. And I think honestly, this can be traced back. An easy fix is allowing them to use some of the stuff that helps with the grip. And you look at the research on grip strength right now isn't conclusive. The grip strength obviously doesn't lead to more spin. Maybe you could say it does, but it could lead to better health outcomes. And I think at this point you can kind of hear some of the players talking about these balls and not being able to grip them. And trust me, as a batter, they want the pitchers to have control. And this might relieve some of the stress in the elbows. But some of the studies are inconclusive. And I think they've gone really hard in the direction of getting rid of spider tack, getting rid of suntan lotion. You can only use rosin or a certain amount. They're checking. If you remember all the ridiculous stuff, Sergio Romo pulling down his pants, they still check on the mound. It isn't as egregious as it was, but this is a complete overcorrection because of the embarrassment they felt with the Houston Astros. They want to make sure they're on Front Street with everything. And that's really the top of the domino here. That's the first domino to fall, knocking everything over. They were embarrassed by Houston.
I can go further than that because you're right. Baseball now has, they're like self-conscious about fixing something that might make them look bad immediately and maybe going overboard. And you said the Houston thing, but let's go back to the steroid scandal, right? Sure. It goes back there because for the longest time, baseball did nothing. Bud Selig did nothing. He knew, everyone knew what was going on. And they turned a blind eye to it because partially it saved baseball. Let's be honest here, right? The McGuire, Sosa, all that stuff saved baseball. It did. You can argue with me if you want, but it saved baseball. All right. Now, was it being done in a completely moral way? No. But they turned a blind eye to it. And then obviously everyone was found out, or maybe not everyone, but a lot of people were found out. And then they tried to go back and correct it by basically almost blackballing some of these guys. You have some of the greatest players of all time that will never be in the Hall of Fame. So it goes all the way back to that, where now Rob Manfred is trying not to make some of those same mistakes as Bud Selig did. But you also can go the other way wrong. And I think the grip stuff, spider tack, fine. Spider tack is probably ridiculous and too much and more than somebody should need. Can we play the glass now?
Yeah, clip? We have the glass now clip. Just to put context on this, this is an old glass now clip before he had the contract with the Dodgers. He's still a member of the Tampa Bay Rays, but this brings to light, especially with all the conversation, a 2-minute clip. I know it's long, but I think it's worth talking about and listening to. So let's hear what Tyler Glasnow had to say.
But I 100% believe that contributed to me getting hurt. No doubt, without a doubt. I think like it's ridiculous. I have used sticky stuff before. It's ridiculous that like, it seems like this whole public perception of like, oh, it's just like select few people. Like your favorite pitcher probably 50 years ago was using something too. Like if you felt these balls, how inconsistent they were, like you have to use something. So in the past, my like substance of choice is sunscreen and rosin. Like just nothing egregious, something to where I can get a grip on the ball so it doesn't feel dusty. But two starts ago against the Nationals, I went cold turkey, nothing. And before that start, I remember when all this stuff came out, I was talking to people and talking to doctors, and they were like, the thing that maybe MLB doesn't realize or that players don't realize is like, what is the injury? Like, what is the prevention of like, maybe it'll add to injuries. And in my mind, I was like, that sounds dumb. That sounds like an excuse a player would use to make sure he can use sticky stuff. But I threw to the Nationals, with nothing. I've never been, I don't use sticky stuff to, I don't use spider tack. I don't need more spin. I have huge hands. I spin the ball fine. I want grip. I did well against the Nationals, probably one of the best starts I had all year. I woke up the next day and was like, I am sore in places that I didn't even know I had muscles in. Like, I felt completely different. I switched my fastball grip and my curveball grip. I've thrown it the same way for however many years I've played baseball. I had to change. I had to put my fastball deeper into my hand and grip it way harder. And I had to, instead of holding my curveball at the tip of my fingers, I had to dig it deeper into my hand. So I'm like choking the shit out of all my pitches. My cue I used to use with Snyder was hold the ball like an egg, like nice and loose, be loose. That's out of the window. So I now have to develop a new cue. I have to develop something where I can't hold the ball light anymore. I have to dig it deep into my hand. So I'm taking it, and you have to think, I'm not a doctor. I know you guys probably know that, but I'm taking a fastball. I'm squeezing the ball twice as hard. So all of this is, I'm recruiting all these muscles, and I'm taking my arm as hard as I can.
All right. So Tyler Glasnow, and I'm not sure if the audio was messed up there. It was in one of my ears. So hopefully you guys heard that okay. But he went on, and honestly, first of all, aside from the content in it, how refreshing is it to hear a player having a candid conversation that feels like he's a human being? Because we're so used to the rote stock answers we get in post games. It's refreshing to hear someone like Glasnow out there just being honest and being a genuine conversational person.
Yeah, I agree. When I saw that, I felt the same way. Just like, you weren't necessarily doing anything wrong. You're kind of doing what was accepted. So you shouldn't feel ashamed of it. And it should be an honest discussion. And that's what I think the players and, you know, the union and the players and the league need to have these discussions together before making rash decisions. I think that would help. And I'm not sure that's actually happening.
Yeah. And looking at the spider tack thing, it's an overcorrection because I think priority is offense. And when we saw the offense dip and we saw some of the pitchers getting the best of these offensive players and honestly embarrassing them for a bit, I think back to Gerrit Cole's Cy Young season with the Astros. To me, that is one of those things that was an overcorrection, and people can make the argument, was he using spider tack? Was he not? Even if he was, it is an accepted thing that that was what's used to help grip these balls. And if you're going to change the texture and the way these balls are manufactured, you have to account for the pitchers that are throwing them at a high level. And as Glasnow said, he's talking about the muscles in his arms not feeling right. And that type of stuff, whether it's not, it's not a scientific study, this is an informal conversation, but that should be taken into account. I think that's the frustration on the MLBPA side, is that that's not the conversation. Instead, they double down, get greedy, and then take more time off the clock to speed up the game because they're recognizing how much it is. They shaved off 30 minutes as far as average goes, and that's exciting to them. So let's shave off another 15 because it excites the casual fans. And, you know, we have this conversation in all different mediums, all entertainment, wrestling, football, like they do things to account for the fans that are not there. And in turn, you're upsetting who's there anyway, the diehards. For me, I never complain about the length of the game. Do I enjoy the pitch clock? I think it has sped up the game immensely, but I never sat there and said I didn't like baseball because it was too long. That's the complaint you got from so many other people that didn't watch baseball. So it's the age old conversation. Do you even want those people in house watching the game if they don't appreciate for what it is? And at this point, it has affected the players on the field, because if it is the pitch clock, if it is the grip, if it's a combination of all of it, you're affecting the best players in the world right now that can't take the field because of the injuries they're accruing.
Yeah. And I mean, to go back to what Glasnow was saying and the whole talk about grip, to me, the stuff that they need to use for grip, I would guess is mostly for the spin rate kind of stuff. And I saw some graphics in a couple different places that I thought were pretty interesting about the percentage of fastballs that are being thrown versus sliders or versus non-fastballs. So the first one I saw, and this was put out by Baseball is Dead, pretty well-known podcast, that the league-wide pitch trends, if we go to 2014, it was 63% fastball, 14% slider. 2019, so 5 years later, 59% fastball, 18% slider. So a little increase. 2024, we're down to 55% fastball, 23% slider. So the rate of slider has gone up pretty dramatically in the last 5 years. The one that I found even more astounding, this was just on MLB Network today. So they don't just talk about sliders. It's just non-fastball usage percentage. They go all the way back to 2015, 43.1% non-fastball usage. And we'll jump ahead. I won't go through every year. Let's jump ahead to 2019, 47.4% non-fastball usage. 2024, we're up to 52.9% non-fastball usage. So more than half the pitches being thrown are non-fastballs. If you told a pitcher that pitched 30 years ago, 20 years ago, I don't think they'd believe it, because what it used to be is, you know, fastball to get ahead and maybe a fastball up or out of the zone sometimes to try to get someone swinging. But then when you get someone in a favorable count, 1-2 count, 0-2 count, maybe that's when you see a breaking ball, all right, to get them to go after that. But it's more of a head game, get them off balance, mess with their timing. That's what it used to be. Let's mess with their timing. Let's move the ball around to different locations so they don't get comfortable. Now it's just, we need to blow everybody away and spin the crap out of the ball to just get swing and miss constantly. And now sometimes not only do you have the pitch clock that is making you possibly work harder, but a lot of times you are working harder just to get an out because you're trying to get everyone out by a strikeout instead of getting some contact outs. There's very few pitchers I can think of that nowadays that, you know, can get guys out and keep their pitch count lower because they're being economical with their pitches. You know, they're having ground outs early in the count, getting a guy to fly out in the first or second pitch of an at-bat. So I think it goes to the types of pitches are being thrown, the lack of grip being able to be used, the change in the baseballs, the pitch clock, on and on and on, and mainly the obsession with velo and spin.
And I think so the conversation goes, do we just accept the injuries for what they are and they're going to happen, or are there rule changes that can incentivize to not have these injuries happen right here? So the one thing I did bring up, and I was doing the research here, and Jonathan Loaisiga obviously is down, and he's not a starting pitcher, but he's a big piece to the Yankees bullpen. He's been beleaguered with injuries really since 2016. This dude has been in and out of being under the knife here. But looking at some of the other approaches here, and there's been some conversation about how to reduce recovery time. Because as you said before so beautifully, I think at some point you just need to put it on the calendar and expect you're going to need some level of Tommy John surgery or elbow surgery in some capacity if you're going to choose this as a profession. But there's conversations, and the only reason that's brought to my radar was because of it's Jonathan Loaisiga, and he's on the Yankee, you know, on the Yankee team, and I'm obviously watching them very closely. But Dr. Jeffrey Dugas has been talking about this internal brace procedure that requires less recovery time for the UCL if it's the partially torn. So apparently, collagen-coated fiber tape suture anchors the damaged UCL, which speeds up recovery time, eliminating the time needed for a tendon to transform into a ligament. So Meister has pioneered combining traditional Tommy John surgery with the use of an internal brace. When it's referred to different than conventional Tommy John, it's called a hybrid procedure. It's what Jacob DeGrom had last year. And it's also what they're looking at for Shohei Ohtani and what they did for him. It wasn't confirmed that that's what it was, because we didn't get the details of what happened under the knife, but apparently they're going to do this because it's reducing the recovery time. And that shows me that a lot of these players are expecting this to continue, that this trend is not going away, that injuries are going to continue to happen. Because you can talk until your face is blue about trying to fix the game and trying to fix the injuries. You have Jason Stark proposing the double hook rule where the pitching team loses their DH once the starting pitcher leaves the game. You can have the conversation like JV was talking about with the same thing, incentivizing letting guys get through the lineup three times instead of having them go out there and just mix and match, and by punishing the team that changes their pitchers. I don't know if there's an answer. And there's also the conversation about, and I thought this was insane, calling any ball that's over 94 miles per hour a ball to stop pitchers from throwing too fast, which I thought that was insane. But that's the conversations that we're forced to have because of that. So these are things that people are throwing into the think tank about how to fix this injury thing. In my opinion, unfortunately, we're not going to see a reduction unless, like you said before, it starts at a institutional level where you're teaching kids to pitch differently. Because right now, I hate to say and be that doom and gloom pessimist, but the generation now, they're cemented who they are. Whoever's in the minor league system, whoever's like deep into college and they're playing really competitive baseball, they've already learned how to pitch. It's about teaching the kid who's 4, 5, 6, 7 years old at this point before they get to a level that's competitive.
The internal brace procedure, I think Lucas Giolito actually is going with that too, or already did. So that's becoming a more popular thing. But I don't think it's the kind of thing as far, and I'm obviously not a medical professional here, but I'm pretty sure you have to be a candidate for that. It's not like anyone that has a UCL issue can choose between the two. And the internal brace, I do believe, is a, like you said, a shorter comeback usually. But I think there has to be some kind of something they see with the UCL where you're actually a candidate for that. But I'm pretty sure Giolito is one of those guys. I'll be honest. I almost trust the medical field to like find advancements to like, you know, help with it more than I do MLB to make changes to figure something out. Maybe that's the pessimist in me. One of the things you mentioned was what you said, Jason Stark said. I heard it from Justin Verlander. He said he's talked to Scherzer about it last year when they were both Mets about, you know, somehow incentivizing guys to go deeper into games. Because if a guy wants to go deeper into games, they are not going to want to throw as hard. They're not maybe going to want to put all their muscle into spin rate. Now there's a lot of guys in the league that are perfectly fine with being five and fly guys. All right. Because if they can go five, but strike out 10 dudes, people see those numbers and you get paid. Whereas if it's more like, hey, I want to go six, seven innings, or I want to get through the lineup three times because that helps my team keep the DH in our lineup. I think there's something there. I do think there's something there. And I don't think that is that crazy out there, especially considering all the changes they've been willing to do recently. You know, Theo Epstein was behind a lot of these rule changes that they tried in the minors and then brought up to the majors. I think he's back in the Boston. Isn't he back in Boston in the Boston fold, or is he still with MLB?
I believe he's back with Boston. I'll get that and confirm it. But I do remember reading the article that he was back, not really involved in more.
It's a different role.
Higher level. Yeah.
I would like to see what he has to say about that, because he's come up with some pretty good stuff, and I'm sure there's other people involved with him, but he's been the face of it. But I think there's something to that idea of incentivizing guys going deeper into games. I think that then changes the thought process of how you're going to pitch.
So he is currently a senior advisor and part owner of the Fenway Sports Group, which owns the Boston Red Sox and Liverpool FC. So he's a high level. I don't think he's day to day. He's not assessing prospects and going out to look at some of the live arms out there. But this dude has a lot of pull in the baseball world. So if he recommends something, he has a lot of people on speed dial to have a conversation. So, but you're right. I think changing rules and implementing things in the favor of the pitchers needs to be done, at least in good faith, to quell some of the tension that's been there. And we know that MLBPA is anxious about what's going to happen down the line, but it's a give and take. It's a seesaw of like trying to balance offense and pitching and all with the sanctity of the game in mind and all the numbers and not offsetting the errors and being able to still compare 1948 to 2024 and have that in mind. Cause the thing that baseball has to fight against, unlike a lot of other sports, is the history, where a lot of the numbers have to be apples and apples. You have to sit and at least romanticize. And that might be naivety. It might be just baseball fans being romantic about it, but you have to be able to compare players of a bygone era to the players today. That's what makes baseball baseball. And if you're not able to do that, sometimes there's a little bit driven away from those long-term fans. And maybe MLB doesn't care about that anymore. Maybe they still want to instill the 8-year-old, instead of watching soccer or basketball, they want them to watch baseball, and they don't care about the legacy of, you know, the 45-year-old guy watching on his couch with a, you know, keeping score with a pen and pencil, you know? So I don't know what the answer is, but it is something that needs to be addressed, because it's, although you can't blame it on just a pitch clock, it is something that is an institutional error that at the very least needs to be addressed and conversated about. Let's have a conversation.
Yeah, they can do something, and they need to do something. And yes, it's a difficult, complicated issue, but you know what? Like I tell my 3-year-old all the time, we can do hard things. Mr. Manfred, we can do hard things. We can do it. We'll hold your hand through it. We can do it. But you know when something will get done? The commissioners work for the owners, right? So Rob Manfred works for the owners, tries to make the owners as much money as possible. That's his job. I wouldn't think the owners are going to be very happy when they keep on throwing out hundreds of million dollars to these pitchers who then don't pitch for a year and a half at minimum. So maybe that is what's going to start changing things when he gets a call from these guys like, listen, I just paid this guy or committed $300 million to this guy. And he's, you know, started, let's say, 2-3 games, and now he's out until 2025, 2026. I wouldn't think they were very happy, would be very happy about that.
I mean, you could blame the Nationals front office, but the Steven Strasburg thing is the most egregious version of it. I mean, how many pitches did he throw with signing a new contract? They said it was like 55 pitches or something. So it's alarming what these injuries are, and there's a lot invested, because that's the other conversation we didn't even have. You mentioned before, there's a lot of money on the line. All these owners are paying these players that they should be playing and contributing at some level. And the other thing that is a conversation that we'll probably have in the future, and there's nothing concrete yet, is the changing of what TV rights deals are going to be. And that's affecting every entertainment medium. That's a big influx of cash for every franchise. That's a sustainable, consistent income that they have to rely on. And that's where a lot of their funding comes from. If that money changes, because you're not going to have traditional cable in houses, and what happens if you go fully on a streaming service, that complicates things. And that might play a part into the ownership conversation, that what makes baseball as attractive as it is to whatever entertainment outlet that wants to get them, whether it's Amazon or Apple TV full time or whatever it may look like. The conversation needs to be had that we need to put our best product in the field. And that includes the best pitchers, because they're just as much important as the offense.
True. I mean, I guess let's stay tuned. We'll see.
Stay tuned. And this conversation was great. So we'll definitely touch back on this, and hopefully things work out with Spencer Strider. And I just saw Framber went on the IL. It seems like Framber is kind of be down for the count, but if the reports come back for Strider, it's not good. You're hearing a lot of bad things about it, but hopefully Strider is good, because he's important to me. He's one of the most exciting players, not just pitchers, to watch in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Josiah Gray today gets scratched and go on the IL, elbow issue. Nick Pivetta, who's a big strikeout guy, flexor strain in the elbow or something along those lines. That doesn't sound great. I haven't seen what the timeline there is. It's like two or three guys a day right now. And you know, other guys are going to start getting scratched just because they're freaking out when they feel any elbow pain. Like now with all this going on, it's going to mess with pitchers' heads, and I can't blame them.
So we'll keep you guys updated on this and continue to check out The Athletic and Fangraphs, and all those guys are dropping great articles. Go on Twitter and follow some of the accounts that we're talking here. And most importantly, follow us on Instagram. We're going to be posting stuff about this and having conversations at Table Setters Pod on IG, also on X. But let's get into some more conversation here with some other quick mentions about some other things going on. All right, leading the charge here, talking about the Padres' huge comeback last night, and Fernando Tatis Jr. hit a go-ahead two-run home run with two outs in the eighth, two innings after the Padres scored seven, and San Diego stunned the Chicago Cubs 9-8 on Monday night. And for historically, you know I love numbers, Devin, and some anniversaries and romanticizing things. This was the 20th anniversary of the first Padres game at Petco Park. So what a way to go out and celebrate. They were down 8-0 at one point. Tatis led the charge here, and how exciting for the San Diego crowd to witness this.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. If you stayed at the ballpark, that's great stuff. And Padres are going to go the way that Fernando Tatis go. I believe it. I know they have Manny Machado there, but I think as Tatis goes, the Padres will go.
So Tatis was wearing custom cleats honoring the late Hall of Famer Tony Gwynn. Rookie Jackson Merrill was aboard on a leadoff walk to get going, and they kind of went off to the races with this comeback. So this win tied the Padres' most significant comeback in franchise history. So they also won three other games after trailing by 8 runs: May 23rd, 1970 at the San Francisco Giants, June 10th, 1974 versus the Pirates, and July 8th, 2021 against the Nats. So, and for the Cubs, on the downside of things, you know that doesn't happen a lot. They have won 234 consecutive games that led by 8 or more runs. Their last such loss came June 28th, 2002 at the Chicago White Sox. So huge comeback, and never say never in baseball. You got to get all 27 outs. And maybe if you were feeling lucky middle of the game, if you would have put the money on a live bet on the Padres down 8-0, could have made a significant chunk of change.
Yeah. What would the line be there?
I mean,
that'd be hefty.
Plus 2,200, something like that. Maybe more.
Maybe probably more. Yeah.
Yeah. So looking at the Yankees here, and of course the Yankees just finished up as we're recording here with Carlos Rodon getting the win 3-2, grinding it out against Miami. The main conversation was Nestor Cortez dominant yesterday. And as I mentioned before, I quoted it as Rob Manfred's wet dream of a quick game, 2 hours and 1 minute. The lifeless Marlins went down, mostly because their offense sucks, but Nestor Cortez has a lot of credit to that. 8 strong with 6 Ks, only allowing 2 hits. Yankees look great yesterday. They're sitting, as of today, with the win, 10-2 at the top of the AL East. And as advertised, and they're doing things without Gerrit Cole. He's one of those guys also hurt. with the conversation with the injury. So when he comes back reinforcement wise, Yankees looking good and there's vibes there. Verdugo had a home run. He's barking in the dugout, feeling himself.
It's not your classical, well-mannered Yankees. This is a different vibe, and I think fans are loving it.
Aaron Boone limited him to wear one chain. I'm not sure if you saw that report. he's been wearing three or four during the game, but Aaron Boone had said, "No, Doogie, you only can wear one." So
I saw we'll Soto with the Soto with the backwards hat during a post-game interview the other night. I mean, maybe it's only a matter of time before we got some facial hair going.
Possibly. I mean, we also have new world heavyweight champion Damian Priest was at Yankee Stadium today. He was interacting with Aaron Judge and also with Juan Soto. Really cool to see. Dude's a lifelong Yankee fan from the Bronx area. So congrats to Damian Priest, the Archer of Infamy, a proud member of the Judgment Day, cashing in his money in the bank. Now he's at Yankee Stadium doing the media tour. Everyone's talking about Cody Rhodes, but Damian Priest is also a world champion.
Yeah, some props to him. Yeah, man, the Yanks, especially Nestor, props to him too. I'm a little hard on Nestor. I haven't been convinced that he really is that guy. He was in his all-star year, but if he keeps on doing this, I'll have to shut up.
So speaking of the Mets here over here, we had a good game yesterday. There was a playoff atmosphere, even much so that it was so loud that Drew Smith had a trouble hearing his pitch comm. But if you look at some of the Mets stuff going on here, they've been really downtrodden with some of the losses they've had here. The season did not start the way they wanted to. So the Mets had a 5-game losing streak to start the season. They really needed more from their players, and most of the ire from Mets fans came from a lot of players, but looking at Brandon Nimmo, and Nimmo was hitting some balls hard. He had some bad luck, but he started to walk more, but he entered the game just 3-for-29, which was alarming for Mets fans, but he broke out of that slump 4-for-4 with 2 home runs and 5 RBIs on Monday leading over there. He racked up more hits on Monday than in the previous 9 games combined. So the Mets came out there swinging. It was a very hostile crowd in Atlanta. Very reminiscent for any April game to be that competitive and loud and feeling the atmosphere. I know it's a rivalry and the Mets and the Braves always go at it and they have a long history, but I was surprised to see how heated this game was. And it was awesome to see. And the Mets held on to win.
Yeah. Let me just say this as a Met fan, no more Jorge Lopez in the 9th inning. I know. So Adam Ottavino and Edwin Diaz were both unavailable. the Braves are not the team that you want to have your two best relievers unavailable. The Braves are that kind of team, man, where I don't think they care how much they're down by. They're never out of it. And just suddenly their bats come alive in the 8th and 9th innings. He got away with that by the skin of his teeth. Tyrone Taylor made a great play to maybe save a home run or at the very least a double off the wall. Then Darnold was up to get the last out. And once I saw him, usually ex-Mets just destroy us. He hit a shot, but it was caught towards the warning track. I thought it was gone off the bat. But anyway, that was last night. So we're recording this on Tuesday. I did just see the end of tonight's game. The Mets were down 6-0. They came all the way back 6-5, I think, had a runner on base, and the Braves closed it out. But you know what? As a Met fan, I will give them some props here. If you asked me before this series started, what did I think was going to happen? I would have said I wouldn't be surprised by a sweep. I think the Braves are that good. I think the Mets are still trying to get things together. So even just to get last night's game and then to fight back tonight, I'm encouraged. I really am. And I think they have help on the way with JD Martinez once his body starts to feel right. And Lindor's got to be better at some point. He hit his first home run the other night as well. So I think they're going to get themselves together and they're going to be okay. Maybe not great, but I think they're going to be okay.
So finishing our quick hitters here, we have Trevor Story being out for the year with a shoulder injury. So the question we're asking everybody is, are the Red Sox done now? Do they still have a shot? Did they even have a shot? They've gotten off to a nice start. They lost today 7-1 to the Orioles. They're now sitting at 7-4. I look at the Red Sox as fool's gold. You mentioned the first couple episodes that you believe they're going to be better than people looked at. I honestly don't look at, and then Trevor Story is a free agent sign they had. He's being paid a lot of money. I don't think he's the most important piece in that team. So I kind of have the same rhythm to what I'm feeling from the Red Sox here. I think they need some pitching and some help here. It sucks to see him out for the year because he did get off to a nice start, but you know, I still think it's business as usual in Boston and they'll find someone to replace him.
I feel bad for Story. I'm a Trevor Story guy. I've liked him for a long time from back, early on in Colorado. It sucks, man, because he got to Boston, and I feel like ever since he's been there, he just hasn't been able to stay healthy for a full season. Finally came back and really was looking like his old self, playing a really good shortstop, hitting the ball, you know, just doing a little bit of everything. And that's the kind of player he is. And he always kind of got shit in Colorado, as all Colorado players do, as like, oh, his numbers are inflated because he plays in Colorado. He's really not that good. And I think he was kind of prepared to try to prove that wrong finally. I do think it matters to them. I have said from the beginning, since preseason, that I thought the Red Sox were going to be better than everyone was acting like they were going to be. And I think they were on their way. I think this is a rough one. I do think this is a rough one.
So as you mentioned before, he's undergoing season-ending surgery to repair a fractured glenoid in his left shoulder. This was reported by Alex Spire of the Boston Globe. If you guys did not see it, he landed awkwardly after attempting a diving stop on a grounder during the game on Friday. The recovery that they're putting out there, Devin, is 6 months, which obviously ends his season, but means he'll be ready for 2025. And most alarming for his free agent contract is that he's played just 145 of the possible 486 games, 31% in three seasons with the Red Sox after signing that six-year, $140 million contract. Looks like that the Red Sox, we talk about replacing, they are looking at having a platoon of David Hamilton and Romy Gonzalez for shortstop for the time being. So, if you're not watching, obviously people don't watch a video, but the face Devin made was visceral and a reaction that everybody's having because it's a huge downgrade.
I'd say so.
But that's my expectation. That was my I don't expect them to be competitive. Like, to me, it's fool's gold to begin the season. It gets early quick, and then we're watching them. You know, they're doing things, but I don't know. If I'm a Red Sox fan, it's like, just go out there and kind of assess what you have. I don't know. Maybe it's just me being a Yankee hater. I just didn't see anything in them this year. It just sucks because I did like Trevor Story, the player. You know what I mean? Like, I don't ever want to see anyone get hurt. It was nice to see he was getting off to a good start, but this is going down in Red Sox history as one of the worst free agent deals in their history. It has to be, right? Because they're usually on the better side of things. They let players go before they turn a little bit sour, but they're on the bad side of this right now.
Maybe try to keep a Mookie Betts or a Xander Bogaerts. Maybe. I don't know. Just saying.
Yeah, that money would have been well served elsewhere. But so let's get to our next segment. Take a pitch or swing away. We're going to be buying or selling. All right, Devin, I'll let you lead the way in this segment talking about our three buy and sell topics.
All right. First one here. The statement is very simple. You can react. Ronel Blanco is for real.
I am buying this. I think what he did on the game following up the second start after his no-hitter, he did something that has not been done in almost 90 years. He went into the sixth inning with another no-hitter in a 3-1 win. He had 14 consecutive innings and 44 outs without allowing a hit, which is the best start for a season by a pitcher since at least 1961. So he wasn't as dominant, but that's a great Texas lineup. He did that against. I think he's for real. And I think Houston has a history and a track record of finding gold in the weird spots. And I think Ronel Blanco is going to be a huge piece to what they're doing this year.
Yeah, man. What a find. What a find. It's crazy to be so convinced to buy this after two starts. But I'm with you. If you watch him, he passes the eye test. And like you said, the Texas Rangers lineup is a hell of a lineup. So that's pretty convincing. His changeup is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. Maybe we need to teach more people to stop all the spinning and do a little more changeup kind of stuff. Because, I mean, you look at some great pitchers in history that can really throw a good changeup, look like a Johan Santana, right? Like, if you can throw that pitch, it can be a great out pitch. I think Blanco's throwing it like 35% of the time, which is a pretty high rate for that type of pitch. So, yeah, I'm with you. Unbelievable start so far. I'm not a big Astro guy, as there's very few people that aren't Astro fans that like the Astros, but I am rooting for him. I will be rooting for him.
So just to put a bookmark in the take a pitch swing away, we do have some breaking news here while we're recording. The Baltimore Orioles are calling up the shortstop and top overall prospect Jackson Holliday, according to a Jeff Passan tweet. So he's been poised to crack the opening day roster, but didn't. We didn't think we would wait long to see him, and we did not. So he's going to be popping in here from AAA, getting on the bus and heading over to Baltimore. And this dude was with a line of 342, 490, and 605 with two home runs, four doubles, and a stolen base. We knew he was ready. exciting to see. This is appointment watching and just makes the Baltimore Orioles even more exciting to watch. So very pumped that they're doing this.
So he's got to play every day, right? Because like you answer, Colton Cowser is also a very high prospect, top 100, probably I think top 30, right? He tore the cover off the ball in spring training and he has not been playing every day. He's been playing, but not every day. So if Holiday's up, I mean, Jordan Westbrook's done a pretty nice job. Obviously Gunner at short. I think Ramon Urias has been playing most of third. So it's gotta be, do you think it's third for Holiday?
Or second right now? I mean, because Mateo's there and Kemp you also have, so you could put him there.
But isn't Westbrook playing second?
Yeah,
it's just a log jam there, man. It's unbelievable.
But you have to imagine they're not calling him up if he's gonna sit on the bench. Someone else has to fall in line and it's a good problem to have. Too much depth and too much offense.
And you still got Kobe Mayo and Kerstad who are also tearing it up down there. Like these guys gotta play, man, at the major league level soon. They just do.
And he can't DH. I know they're having O'Hearn. He DH'd today. He needs to be in the field playing his game. 20 years old. Let him show off every aspect of his game. He's the number one top prospect in the world for a reason. So I'm excited to see 20 years old, man. Future's bright for the Orioles and baseball. It's so exciting to see.
I agree.
We also have our second buy sell here. The Braves are in trouble if Strider is out for a significant amount of time. So I'll let you lead the way in here because it's also mentioned that Max Fried is also struggling pitching wise for them.
Yeah, Fried has been in rough shape so far. I think he'll correct it, but it's been ugly so far for him. For almost every other team in the league, almost, I would buy this. I would swing away at this and say they were in trouble. Because it's the Braves and what I've seen their offense do, I think they're going to be fine. I do. I think their offense is that good. I think they'll figure out enough pitching. I don't think their team ERA is going to be top 15 in the league. I think it'll be bottom 15 in the league. And I think they will still get close. I still think they'll be able to get in the 90s as far as wins go. And we also don't know if Strider's out for the whole year either. It's a sprain of the UCL as far as what we've heard so far. So what that means, I'm not sure we know yet for timeline. Obviously, they'll be very, very careful. But I'm gonna take the pitch and sell this because their offense is just that good.
I'm taking the pitch as well. They have plenty of starting pitching depth in the minors. Of course, nothing is going to be what Strider offers. It's going to be a huge substantial drop off, but I think the offense can account for it. As you said, we don't want to eulogize Strider's season because I'm hoping we get some good news here, but he was looking to become the fastest in MLB to reach 500 Ks among pitchers ever. So like it puts in perspective what he's able to do. And just also for clarification, he already had one Tommy John surgery back in 2019 when he was at Clemson. So, you know, as you said before, he's schedule one, and that fits the timeline. 5 years later, he's on deck for another one. A lot of innings on the arm, 25 years old. You know, after the second one, he's probably going to come back stronger than ever. But it just sucks to see him being on the shelf for him until middle of 2025 is not what you want to see.
Agreed. Last one in this segment. The statement is Jackson Churio will have a better rookie season than Wyatt Langford.
I'm going to take the pitch, even though Churio has come off to a better start here. And the line you have here is 278, two home runs, 70 RBIs, one stolen base. Most importantly, great defense and a 788 on base. Langford right now has no home runs. He's getting on base at a decent rate, 256. Let's just be honest. Both these guys are going to be the favorites for NL and AL Rookie of the Years. I'd be surprised if either one didn't win these awards. Both are super young. You can look at all the stats here where Churio has racked up 9 hits and 32 at-bats, 2 homers. He's been impressive. He was the youngest Brewer to go deep since Gary Sheffield in 1988. So he looks very much legit in the major leagues. As far as Langford goes, it's been a little bit slower, but he's always put up huge numbers everywhere he's been. We've seen numbers there. He's the number four overall pick, 2023. It's going to take a little bit right here. He's got to tap into the power. We're going to see it. I think they're going to come in a huge clip. 111.4 miles per hour max exit velocity is happening off the bat here. I think he's just near missing some bad luck here. So I think Wyatt Langford will be there. I still think he has a better season. But both these dudes, put money on in the futures. They're both winning Rookie of the Years this year and lock it up.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of reluctantly swing away at this and say Churio will have the better season only because I think Churio has more pathways to a solid season. I just think there's more things he can do where people then can like look at his final stat line and be like, oh, wow, he had a really good season. Whereas if Langford disappoints in the power department a little bit, let's say he hits under 25 home runs or even under 20, I think that'll be seen as a little bit of a disappointment. And if his average is down in like the 220s or 230s, same thing, where like he's got to hit for decent average, let's say 270 or above, or let's say 260 or above, 260 or above, and I think hit at least in the mid-20s of home runs. That's people's expectation right now because of how good, like you said, he's been everywhere he's ever gone. And the hype train was starting to go real fast as we got close to this season. And now he's kind of, for 8 to 10 weeks here, has to step in and make up for the loss of Josh Young as well. Not that they play the same position, but he's kind of taken his spot in the lineup certain nights. So I think that's a big responsibility.
Agreed. And I think it's exciting to watch both of them. I think it's a matter of time. And I know I mentioned it ad nauseum last week, but once the weather gets warmer in Texas, that ball's flying out of there. And you look at some of the advanced stats numbers and obsessing over them, his exit velo is there. Like it's off the bat. The miles per hour is there. It's going to find its way out of the ballpark. And I think we're looking at a guy who's going to have 25 to 30 home runs all said and done end of the year, as long as he stays healthy. So let's get to our, in honor of Mr. Rose, talk about our bets that inevitably I never hit. All right, Devin, guide us through here, because obviously I'm not the expert in betting here. I'm going to continue to take stabs at this, but another miss for me on this week.
I mean, I'm not going to call myself an expert either, but I'll go through mine first here. So last week, I had the Royals money line in the Cole Reagans versus Corbin Burns game against the Orioles. I had this correct almost the whole game, and then the Royals blew it in the ninth, but that's still wrong is wrong. You know, I don't get any bonus points for being close. And then I had the Cardinals Padres. It was Zach Thompson pitching for the Cardinals, Musgrove pitching for the Pods. I just had over a half a run in the first inning, and I hit that one. I did. I think I forget which team scored, but it was 1-0 after one. This week, I am going to go. This is for the Wednesday night games. I'm going to parlay the Giants money line against the Nationals. That's Jordan Hicks versus Patrick Corbin. Hicks has been very, very good so far, becoming a starting pitcher that so far, I know it's early, looks like a great signing by the San Francisco Giants. And I will also, so I'll parlay that with the Guardians money line versus the White Sox. That's Tanner Bibee versus Eric Fetty. The parlay only gets you to plus 115 odds, but I'm trying to be safe there. If I want to get a little crazy, maybe you'll sprinkle a little bit on a Jose Ramirez home run in that game against the White Sox, because it's the White Sox.
So looking at my bets from last week, I had the Phillies over 4.5 runs at the Reds game. I believe they had 2 runs on that day, so that did not hit. This week, I'm dipping into my bag of tricks here, and I'm doing a little bit more. I don't have the numbers yet because the line's not available, but Logan Gilbert over 5.5 Ks. He's had 8 and 7 respectively in his first 2 starts. Phillies money line. You have Nola versus Lance Lynn. I like the Phillies against St. Louis here, and I'm taking the over in Texas and Oakland as far as runs scored. So I'm going to go on to FanDuel quick and look at what that line is, but parlay all that together. It's a decent payday, but if you're looking to keep your money, I would not bet it, because right now I'm on the coldest streak of all cold streaks.
By the way, we didn't get the Pete Rose bumper. Can we get it as an outro?
Oh,
you have it?
Absolutely, I do have it. So we have to play it as an outro. So I will play it as soon as we're done, but I'm going to get all into right for tomorrow quick if it's up there yet. But
sure.
Looking at St. Louis right now, as far as so that right now, if you take the Phillies money line, it's negative 126, and compile that together, negative 126, and do the over for the runs with the Oakland game and also Texas. So, and I think Texas can do a majority of those, of the run scored there. Looking at some of the stuff here, the best bet is to go with some of the favorites in baseball. If you kind of look at the way it's been going, being, I guess, a little creative on their parlays, that's how Vegas or whoever you want to look at it, FanDuel is keeping their money. New York State is keeping their money, because you get kind of obsessed, as you mentioned, sprinkling in the home runs to increase the odds to make the payday better. That's where the parlays don't hit, because you know it's going to be one leg short.
Yeah, typically. Example, tonight I had the Dodgers money line. They took care of business. I had the Yankees by 1.5. So I didn't go money line. I decided to go on the spread. And of course, they only beat the Marlins by 1. Although now that I look at it, the third leg of that parlay was Cole Reagans to go over 5.5 strikeouts against the Astros. I thought that was a low number, and alarm bells should ring when the number seems low, because that's when Vegas knows something. He threw 5 strikeouts. The Astros got to him a bit. So, yeah, you're right. You're always, you miss those parlays by just a little bit.
You also know who always is in tap with it? Pete Rose. Let's go to that bumper here and here. Pete Rose getting Tombstone at WrestleMania, which is the best bumper. I don't know how I didn't play it.
That's Pete Rose! Pete Rose just got Tombstone! Pete Rose just got Tombstone! And this crowd in Boston loved it!
The end is my favorite, where Jim Ross is just saying how much the fans loved it. By the way, Pete Rose, so the Mets were in Cincy in their last series, and when they came back from commercial break at one point, they had the camera on the Pete Rose statue out there, which he's sliding head first. And Gary Cohen made a great remark. You could see the MGM sports book in the background where it looked like Rose was sliding into the sports book, and he made that point. And it was honestly the greatest observation, because that's literally what they've made it look like there.
I mean, we could have a long conversation about it, but like watching all these sports leagues being in bed with the gambling sites.
Oh my God.
Watch, yeah. Pete Rose still demonized. It's still amazing to me. I understand there's a distinction between betting on whatever. And also he made an enemy by lying at first, and I don't know, but I have the character he is, plus the amazing player on the field and being the all-time hits leader. You mentioned before some of the steroid era players not being respected, being in the Hall of Fame. There needs to be a place for Pete Rose in the Hall. To me, he needs to be in the Hall of Fame.
Pete Rose is in the Hall of Fame. It just so happens to be the WWE Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. But with that being said, let's get to a minor issue and talk about some of the stuff happening down on the farm. All right, here in the minor issue, a quick note on an exciting prospect, and we're dipping into the Arizona Diamondbacks system here with not as a highly touted prospect. Everyone's going to the top of the list about some players they're excited about, but we got a little taste about what Jorge Barroza was able to do with the big league club here. He opened the season in AAA Reno, but he was called up by the D-backs, made 2 starts over 3 games, replacing Randall Grichuk. He looked like he belonged there. More season, it makes him exciting to think about. Some stats to think about opening the season. He turned 23 in February. He spent his age 22 season posting a near 400 OBP in AAA, 13 home runs, and a boatload of doubles and triples to compare to true power hitters. Looking at him listed at 5'5", 165 pounds, not your typical power hitter. Looking at some of the videos here, he's a switch hitter. He plays plus defense in the outfield, and obviously that is an essential thing, especially at Chase Field. You need to be able to cover a lot of ground there. Barroza also has premium bat control. He's not striking out a lot. We mentioned before, there's not a huge emphasis on that, but he's a guy who's not going to get you in trouble. And he looked like he belonged there. Like, I know it was only 2 games in 3 and he was a guy who was quickly back on the bus back to Reno, but something to be excited about. It speaks to the volume of and depth that the Diamondbacks have, even at the mid to low tier prospects they have here, which makes it exciting, because this guy Barroza could be a top tier prospect in, let's just use Miami to throw more dirt on them, but in a system that is beleaguered with no depth and really the farm system isn't as eclectic as it was, he'd be a top prospect. And in Arizona, he's forgotten about because there's so much more depth there.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I like that we're not always going for, you know, the low-hanging fruit with the prospects. Like, we could obviously easily do this segment this week about the whole Norfolk Tides team, right, as far as all those Orioles prospects. But everyone's talking about them, and what else can we say that no one else has said so far? Nothing. So to kind of pick some guys like this who are maybe on the outside of that top 100, I think it's fun to do that every once in a while. With Barroza, I mean, it's hard for him to crack the major league squad right now. He got that taste because of some injuries. Obviously, Grichuk came back recently. Alec Thomas is down now, but they still have, you know, Grichuk, obviously, Lourdes Gurriel, who's playing very well, Corbin Carroll, Jake McCarthy in the mix in the outfield. So it might be tough for him to get back up here, barring another injury. But to me, his skill set just reminds me of a guy that could be a little bit, if they make the playoffs, could be that guy off the bench that's just kind of annoying to the other team. Like, he'll do the little things, can do a little bit of everything, has some speed. That's the guy I profile him as, like, not a starter this year, and maybe not a starter for the Diamondbacks. Maybe he's not a future Diamondback. Maybe he moves somewhere else. But I could see that if they get their act together and make the playoffs, which I think they will, I could see him maybe being on that bench and causing some havoc.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is he's walked nearly as often as he struck out over the last 2 years, and that's an asset in baseball. Getting on base is important. So I did like going digging deep into some systems here, and the Diamondbacks, we've been very complimentary of what they've been able to build over time and being excited about who's at the top and the major league ready prospects. But a guy like Barroso was next man up, and obviously Triple A Arena is probably gonna be his home all year, barring any sort of injury happening at the major league level. But clearly he held his own. I mean, the ability to go in there, two starts over three games. I think he had two hits. He looked like he belonged, and he didn't look like a fish out of water. So that's exciting for, you know, just maybe not so much for Jorge Barroso and what it means for the Diamondbacks, but it also just kind of speaks to the system and how they're producing players at a rapid rate.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Like, another note here, the Corbin Carroll stuff. I had actually just tweeted on her, or actually like reposted someone else's tweet before we came on. I'm going to find it now just to show how stupid I look now. We mentioned before how Corbin Carroll homered tonight, right? In his first at bat, he had home run. I think he did. But here it was. Okay. Corbin. So this was before tonight's game. Corbin Carroll has just 4 home runs in his last 303 plate appearances, 363 plate appearances if you include spring training. So I requoted this or reposted it and labeled it something or nothing. Like, do we worry about this or not? And he had hit a home run tonight. So kind of shoved that in our faces. Good timing on his part as far as a Diamondback outfielder goes.
For anyone worried about Corbin Carroll, you're just not paying attention. Like, baseball is a marathon, man. Like, he's just going to be fine. And it's a matter of time. That's why you got to be patient. And just the reactionary stuff. And I know we're sitting here on a podcast talking about baseball. Usually you have a week to let things breathe. But some of these content creators and news articles are doing post games. And there's a lot of this reactionary doom and gloom and pessimistic mentality when you're seeing guys go into slumps. It just happens. It's baseball. So Corbin Carroll would just be fine, and the numbers in the back of the baseball card will always be there. And, you know, this is a dude who's kind of shown that he's an elite player in baseball. So let's have some respect and not get all panicky about a lack of power. It's going to be there.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily think of him as a guy like he's going to put up power numbers, but like, it's not his whole game by any means. Like, he's another guy who does a little bit of everything, runs the bases unbelievably. Like, if it wasn't for Ellie De La Cruz's craziness on the base paths, I think you'd hear a lot more about Corbin Carroll, because he might not look as amazing doing it, but he covers some ground as well out there. And since we're still in the minor issue segment, technically, one quick shout out, Dylan Cruz, who I feel like was kind of pushed down the news because of Wyatt Langford's rise. He had a big night tonight. I think he's in the double A team for the Nats as of now. I wouldn't expect him to be there very long. 4 for 5. He started off 4 for 4, had a chance to go 5 for 5 with a home run and 3 singles. Let's start to watch for his breakout too. Maybe we can have him in this segment one of these weeks.
Absolutely. So we're going to come around third and kind of finish it up and give our wrap up of the week and what we're going to be looking forward to. All right, as we round third and slide into home here to end our episode, looking forward to some things. And of course, watching the product on the field is of the utmost importance. But for me, my eyes are on the off-the-field stuff, players speaking out. I think we're going to see some more players speaking out, especially if the news for Spencer Striders is not what people want to hear. It seems like it's going to be there. And some of the injuries we're seeing, I think we're going to see a little bit more fire and angst from both sides. The clash between the league and MLBPA, it really is a juicy feud. I don't know if we're going to get the payoff that we're looking for. The WrestleMania main event between both sides, but at the very least, it's going to start a conversation that is necessary institutionally for baseball at large, not just Major League Baseball, but how pitchers are developing. And I think it's starting a good conversation for pitchers at all different levels.
I mean, I'll be watching that as well. The one positive that's come out of it, kind of like you alluded to, is there have been some really good conversations in all different places, just post-game interviews like the Verlander one on his rehab assignment. Bringing the old clips up of Glasnow. I've seen some good stuff on MLB Network. Ryan Dempster was making some great points today when they're asking him about it. He was kind of talking about the way we used to pitch. Dallas Braden put a really good tweet out the other night about how he feels like we've kind of reached the end of our, I don't know, our learning of what the body can do. And he put it much better than I am right now, but basically we've gotten to a point where our body cannot sustain anymore with what we've learned to be able to do. Like, we're bigger and stronger, but we've kind of, this is it. We've tapped ourselves out, and we got to be careful. But as far as what I'm looking for, I like to look at the weekend series. There's a lot of good ones this weekend. Last weekend, I said I was going to be watching the Astros and Rangers. They play each other again. But the two that I wrote down were Pirates-Phillies. Pirates had a tough loss today with David Bednar kind of uncharacteristically getting roughed up. If you didn't see it, one thing I loved, Rowdy Tellez in Bednar's post-game interview where he's at his locker, came over and basically put his arm around Bednar and said, let's not forget this guy's a two-time All-Star. He didn't like the booing, not Bednar. Tellez said, I didn't like, you know, I don't think this is something Pittsburgh does. We're a good team. We're going to be fine. He's going to be fine. It was a great act of like team sportsmanship that I saw. So that shows me good signs of what that Pirates team might be. Phillies have not been as hot as maybe we expect them to be. So I think those two Pennsylvania teams, the Phillies with those high expectations and the Pirates kind of as a surprise team, I think that's a great series to watch. And then the other one, Yankees Guardians. Guardians are hot as hell right now. They might have dropped one tonight to the White Sox. I haven't seen the final. I know they were down 5-0, tied at 5-5, were down 7-5. But even so, they're running off some wins, have a really good record. So the Yankees come into town. Two hot teams. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, the Guardians did lose 7-5. They dropped to 8-3, but that's a great start for them. And Jimenez looks great. I have him on my fantasy team. He's hitting the ball at a high rate, and he's out there looking like every bit of an all-star that he can be. So that is an exciting series to talk about. But you're right. I think the Pirates and Phillies series is exciting to think about, especially where the Pirates are. And when was the last time you had both Pennsylvania teams as competitive as they are? The Pirates are usually downtrodden going – you know, against the Phillies, and they're just trying to have this, you know, one-upmanship, or just like, okay, we have an in-house rivalry here, but it seems like there's a lot to play for Pittsburgh. And as you mentioned, the galvanized effect of this team, they feel like they are approaching a different level, where that's what winning does. And you can see it's a well-built team, that they have each other's backs, and that goes a long way. Analytics can't assess that, like the feeling in the locker room, and we know how badly it can go. You can go back to the Nats team back in the day. That was a really good team, but Papelbon and Harper didn't get along, and that was a glimpse into what was actually going on in that locker room. And this is the exact opposite effect, where Rowdy Tellez has the back of one David Bednar, and that's a good thing to see, because it's, you know, everyone is going to have a bad day, and Bednar needs everybody to have his back, and can't be booing this early in the season. But that booing is also a sign of Pittsburgh has high expectations. It shows what a hot start will do.
Yeah, man. And with Pittsburgh, like we talked about, Jackson Holliday on his way up now, which is what everybody wanted. Another guy that everybody wants is Paul Skeens. If the Pirates can sustain this, let's say through like mid-May, I think the Pirates front office, their hands are going to be forced here, where they're going to have to give the people what they want. They're not going to have the excuse of like, oh, you know, the team is below 500. Let's let him develop. There's no reason to rush him. Like, you got to get him up here if he's one of your best five pitchers, if you're doing really well, right? In a very winnable division. And as long as he's built up, he's only really been pitching three innings at a time his first two starts. So let's build that up. And mid-May, end of May, let's get him up here.
So next week, we'll be back for episode 5 of Table Setters, breaking down all the weekly action in Major League Baseball, talking about all the games we just discussed, going over our bets inevitably where mine didn't hit. I'm actually going to put this one in because I feel confident in Logan Gilbert, what he's able to do tomorrow. But you guys can follow us on Instagram at Table Setters Pod, also on Twitter at Table Setters Pod. Please support the show. Leave a 5-star review if you feel so inclined. Interact with us. Send some tweets over there on Twitter. See Devin interacting with a lot of different baseball content creators. But start the conversation. You want to hear us talk about something, you disagree with something, or you agree with us strongly. What are your thoughts on the arm injuries? Let's start the conversation and like your feedback for the next episode so we can bring it out here. And again, this is our 4th episode. I know we're only growing. We want to grow the community and have future conversations about the betterment of baseball at large. So it's been a blast doing this. As always, Devin, have a great time having these conversations.
Yeah, man, it's been great. Let's hear some of your ideas about how to fix the pitching injuries. I want to see if anyone has some outlandish ideas there.
Yeah, maybe stick away from the every pitch over 94 miles per hour is a ball, because that's not the world I want to live in.
Listen, man, the NFL is slowly going to flag. Maybe we just turn this into wiffle ball.
All right, guys. Well, we'll be back next week talking all things Major League Baseball and everything in between. But until then, we'll talk to you after a while.
That has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.